Well, we welcome you to another installment of Ministers Joe and Josh Discuss, though I'm not a minister anymore. So it's Minister Joe and Just Josh Discuss. And we are in the middle of our conversation through the book of Genesis. We're now in Genesis chapter 44, beginning in verse 14. What do you think? Can we jump right in, or do we need to catch our folks up with anything?
Well, we can briefly give them the thumbnail, I think. Jacob, the father, says, go back to Egypt and get some more grain, bring a little of this, a little bit of that, kind of grease the wheels for the money that was found in their sacks. You know, bring Benjamin and maybe your brother back as well, who has been held in jail. So they get there and they get back and they get some more stuff, and they decide, they are greeted with a meal and everything. And Joseph really puts on airs for them, and it's kind of a strange situation where they're sitting around the table in birth order, and they get their servings from Joseph's table, and Joseph gives five times as much to his brother Benjamin. They get sent off on their way back home with the grain and their money in their sacks, and they end up finding themselves in a situation. The steward finds them, and cup that's Joseph's possession is found with Benjamin.
They vowed that whoever had that cup was going to be executed. And yeah. Now we've got to wait and see what happens.
Yes. And the story continues in verse 14, right?
Yeah. So this is verse 14. I'll read this first part. Genesis 44, 14. Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house while he was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to them, "What deed is this that you've done? Do you not know that one such as I can practice divination?" And Judah said, "What can we say to my lord? What can we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Here we are then, my lord's slaves, both we and also the one in whose possession the cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the one in whose possession the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." Then Judah stepped up to him and said, "O my lord, let your servant please speak a word in my lord's ears, and don't be angry with your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead. He alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me so that I may set my eyes on him.' We said to my lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' Then you said to your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more.' When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my lord. And when our father said, 'Go again, buy us a little food,' we said, 'We cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother goes with us will we go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.' Then your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I've never seen him since. If you take this one also from me and harm comes to him, you'll bring down my gray hairs in sorrow to Sheol. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then, as his life is bound up in the boy's life, when he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die. And your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became surety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I will bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain as a slave to my lord in place of the boy, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the suffering that would come upon my father.'" And then we'll finish with this. "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, 'Send everyone away from me.'" I don't know. Our way into this section is multiple. Like, there are multiple strands we've been talking about that could get us into this. Mm-hmm. But we might as well start with their response to Joseph when they're brought back. What do you think of these guys?
Well, they're scared stiff. They don't know what's going on, and their world's crashing in because they know if they go back without Benjamin or without the grain or have made amends with this man, that it's more than likely going to put their dad over the edge.
Joseph is still carrying on the charade that he's Egyptian, right? Do you think when he says, "Don't you know I can practice divination?" Do you think he means that he is practicing divination, or do you think this is just part of the obscuring of his identity?
It could look like, or some people could accuse him of being able to use the cup for divination. But I've also heard too, though, that I think along this lines is that he was using this as part of his charade to convince them. I don't think he needed a cup of divination, but some people have also said that, you know, the priest used the Urim and the Thummim or the Urim and the Thummim.
That would be much later. That's under the law of Moses, as you know. So we're talking at least almost 500 years afterwards. But
yeah, some people have said that there were some things that were used for discerning the will of God. But right. I think this is much more than discerning the will of God. This is actually trying to discern the character of his brothers.
Yeah, and he's definitely trying to figure out if they're trustworthy. I agree.
And it seems like they're really, really in a lot of ways, in a sense of desperation, still standing up to integrity. I think Joseph is really number one testing to see if they're really sorry for anything that's happened to him, and whether or not they can see beyond their own personal gain or their desire to be in leadership in the family or have power.
Yeah, this is a well-designed test. And he does get the answers he's looking for. He does find out their true quality. It's interesting. You suspected that the servant was rejecting their suggestion that whoever the cup was discovered with would be killed. Mm-hmm. And this story seems to confirm that he had rejected it, because Joseph doesn't even consider executing anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the brother's rash vow was not ratified. Can you imagine if it was?
Yeah.
Like if the servant had accepted it, if Joseph carried that out, but Joseph doesn't even put that on the table. So he, in some ways, he's testing them, he's messing with them, but he could make it worse.
Yeah. It could go sideways, huh, for them.
But for Joseph, there's something about this test that has to be equal, right? They didn't kill him when they sent him to Egypt. They sold him as a slave. And that's the situation he's putting Benjamin in. Mm-hmm. So there is a bit of, do you think, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth here, that Joseph is trying to put them in the same situation? He's not trying to make it worse.
Yeah, I would think that he's trying to create a scenario where they would have to do a similar type of decision and remembering of what actually happened. Maybe firsthand see their reactions to, since he's got a captive audience, he can monitor how they're actually responding and their facial recognition to the situation and whether or not if they're gonna duplicate, I think is really, really the real test.
Yeah, and there's more than a little bit of irony in the fact that Judah's the one who speaks up. Now, we know that Judah's the one who pledged himself to care for the boy, so it's probably not surprising to us as readers. But for Joseph, I wonder if it was surprising, since it was Judah who came up with the idea of selling him into slavery to get rid of this rival to their father's affections, but more importantly, to the birthright and blessing that comes with being a child of the chosen one.
Mm-hmm.
So to have Judah speak up, It clearly affects Joseph, right? At the end, we see that after he hears Judah's plea, he can't control himself. And I suppose when we get there, we'll ask, what about what Judah said affected him so much? And I know that there are multiple possible answers. But the fact that Judah stepped up, I wonder if that took him off guard. That would be Judah to speak up for Benjamin after his history with Judah.
Right. And he may have assumed that because he heard kind of the conversations and one of, in the beginning of the visits, you know, why did we do this to the boy? I told you that, you know, this was Reuben who was speaking, correct? That said wanted to pull him out of the cistern and bring him back.
Right. Reuben wanted them to put him in a cistern. And then the text tells us that his plan was to then come back in the evening and rescue him.
Right.
But it was Judah who spoke up and said, let's sell him to the Midianites.
Yeah. So maybe he was expecting Reuben to be the one to stand up. And in the text prior, we did hear Reuben try to give Jacob a solution, but it wasn't a good one. It was one that was like, take my kids. And it was too much like Jacob had already experienced with losing his kids. Simeon was in jail. Joseph was presumed to be dead.
Yeah. And we find out a little bit something here. Remember, you and I, and for those of us who've been, for those who've been following with our conversation, will remember this. We weren't sure if Judah was being honest with his father about their interaction with the man who we now know is, we knew was Joseph. They didn't know, but now they're going to know. But when he gave that story to his father, he kind of said that they were questioned and that he asked them specifically about a brother. And we said, well, when we first read that, it sounded like they just gushed that information to Joseph. He didn't really interrogate it out of them. So is Judah being honest with his father, or was he sort of softening the blow and caricaturing the story to make it a little bit sound like it was more Joseph's fault and that they weren't at fault? Well, now Judah reports to Joseph. He re-records the last conversation and he says it in the same way he told his father.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it seem like maybe that's really is how it happened. Is that how you read it? Or
I think to some degree, I mean, I think he tried to candy coat it a little bit with his dad, and there's always that personal interpretation or subjective remembering, if we want to call it that way. But I think it's important to point this out, is the idea of Judah's character anyways that's challenged earlier in Genesis with his experience with Tamar. This seems like a much more honest Judah than in those chapters prior. And we also, I think we established last time that Judah is no young feller. He's had already three boys at least that were married to Tamar.
Not only three boys, but each of them, the first two, old enough to get married.
Yes.
And they both died. And then we know his third son was old enough to be married, but maybe just old enough. And so he used that as an excuse not to marry him to Tamar.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the story of Judah and Tamar playing the prostitute in order to get him to fulfill the Levirate law, what will later be called the Levirate law, and so on. But in that story, Judah doesn't come out very good. And prior to that is the story of Judah's idea to sell his brother into slavery. So Judah has not been a really positive character.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit surprising that he put his own future well-being on the line for Joseph with his father, but there's still a question whether he really meant that or it was manipulative. This is where that gets tested, right?
Yeah, it definitely gets tested here. And he looks good, though. Looks really, really good.
Yeah, Judah's really come around. And of course, he doesn't tell us why or what caused the change, but maybe his response here reveals a few things.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just get us started with something I'm thinking so that I don't, you know, make it sound like a pop quiz or something. But I wonder how you'd respond to this. He goes on a lot in this response with Joseph as to the effect that the loss of their brother had on their father. And the effect he believes the loss of Benjamin will have on him. Do you think, I think the answer to this is yes, but that doesn't mean I'm right. Do you think that Judah did not anticipate the effect that Joseph's death would have on their father and came to regret it more and more the more they saw that effect played out?
Yeah, I think that maybe some of the things for Judah were resonating with his father. Losing his own children,
right?
There might have been some of those things. I know that I went to a wedding recently, and I saw the father of the bride walking down some stairs with the bride, and I felt the emotions that this fellow may have had. I could see it in his face, kind of quivering and smiling, and that awkward feeling. As a father, my son and daughter are married, and just seeing that reminded me of it. So maybe Judah has experienced some of this with loss of his own children.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but I think you're right. That could have a big part of what has softened him. Having lost his two eldest sons, he may have a totally different appreciation of what it was like for his father to lose Joseph. I think that's a really good observation.
And I get a feeling maybe that happened after Joseph was sold.
It did. Yeah, at least in the text, it happened afterwards.
Yeah.
And he has a new appreciation. And he clearly has come to love his father in a way that maybe he wasn't thinking about when he was younger. So there is a lot of change in him. So to follow that line of thought even further, you and I had talked in our last few conversations about how Joseph's test was hurting his father, and maybe Joseph didn't appreciate that. Maybe he wasn't thinking so much about the effect this would have on his father because he was so interested in finding out this information that he wanted to find out. Was Benjamin alive? Was his father alive? Had his brothers changed? Could he trust them? All the things he's trying to figure out. It's having a really negative effect on his dad, as we can see back home. But Joseph doesn't seem cognizant of that. And I wonder if in this moment, one of the things that affects Joseph is that somehow Judah has come to have a greater concern for his dad than he does.
Ooh, well,
I don't know. Yeah. It's speculative, but it does sound to me that Judah at this moment shows a much greater concern for Jacob's mental well-being than Joseph is in doing all these tests. Like Joseph isn't, when he asked Benjamin to come, whatever his agenda is, I don't think it's to hurt his father, but that's the effect. Mm. The effect we saw, right, in our last conversation, how grieved Jacob was over this. And in letting Benjamin go, he almost acts as though he's already lost him.
Mm.
So Jacob's back home grieving under the feeling that maybe Benjamin will never come back. And Joseph put him in that situation. And Judah is desperately trying to make sure it's not permanent.
And you're right, I think, by saying that he doesn't seem to be as concerned about Jacob. That is, Joseph doesn't seem to be concerned or hasn't seemed to have thought all the way through how it would affect his Jacob. But it's obvious that to me that this is part of that situation where he's trying to really get them to really work through this.
Sometimes when we plot for revenge, or even if we're just plotting to uncover hidden truths the way Joseph is, we don't think about the collateral damage to other people who are involved in it. And I wonder if part of this conversation with Judah reveals to Joseph just the effect he's having on his father.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that Joseph is moved at Judah's change of heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's what causes him to lose control. It's possible. But I think it's also dawning on him the effect this is having on his father, and it changes the game for Joseph.
Yeah.
Maybe he always intended to show himself at this moment, but I think something about what Judah said causes him to drop the ruse.
So I mean, Joseph's definitely he's trying to keep this all in, and I think he does see a difference in Judah that you know, as comparison. I'm sure he's getting flashbacks. Boom, boom, boom. Joseph's rushing around with all these thoughts in his mind, and then being in the situation, it's like, how can you process that and still keep a straight face?
And I think this is true in our own lives, that hurt freezes time, and we can be left with the sense that the people who hurt us never change. You know, they're always in the end the same, but there's oftentimes a long road that we ignore because our pain kind of locks us in one space and time. And the way people were at that time is a permanent thing for us because we're kind of stuck in that spot. And I see that with Joseph. He doesn't know that Judah has gotten married and then lost his wife and had three sons and two of them died and then had this really humiliating experience with his daughter-in-law and has now had a child by her, which he didn't intend to do, but he did do, and all the stuff that that reveals about him. He doesn't know that journey. He doesn't know that Judah has come to become protective of his father. He has no idea that Judah pledged his own future as a safeguard for Benjamin. And he certainly wouldn't have expected Judah to mean it, like even if he said it. So a lot of stuff is being revealed to Joseph right now. And Joseph has the wherewithal, I think, to unfreeze time and accept the fact that things have changed and that these are not the same people that did what they did to him. And I think all that coalesces in this moment, and he realizes his father's pain and suffering. And, you know, he probably thought more about himself all those years, like, I'm stuck in Potiphar's house and I'm unfairly arrested and then I'm thrown into prison and I'm stuck here for years and it's taken me forever to climb out. He probably didn't give a whole lot of thought to the grief of his father and that there was someone else back home suffering. And Judah kind of brings all of that back onto the table at once. Not only has your father suffered a terrible grief and he's never been the same, but you've put him back in the exact same position. Now, Judah doesn't know he's talking to Joseph, so that's not what he thinks he's doing. But I think that's what Joseph is hearing. Like, oh my goodness, I've done to my father a second time. My dad suffered. You know, it's just all that comes together. It's almost like Judah unfreezes time and Joseph is suddenly taken from the cistern into the present world of his brothers and father, which was an unknown thing for him. And that's an overwhelming moment. And Joseph lets it happen.
Right. I think also it would be good to say here too that Judah is a good example of a redemptive type of story here,
right?
Where I think it's in the what really breaks open for Joseph is that he's actually seeing this, the bigger picture actually in the bigger picture story, which is about to be revealed in a few moments, is actually something that's already happened in Judah.
That's true.
Which is kind of neat. I think that's what the door opener is for Joseph to see, is that this man who betrayed him is now somebody who is looking to redeem his brother.
Right, and it's an interesting foreshadowing of the ultimate fulfillment of these shadows, which is when Jesus comes as a descendant of the line of David from the tribe of Judah and lays down his life to save his brothers. That's reflected a little bit here in Judah when he's willing to lay down his freedom and his future for Benjamin. Like, obviously that's just for one brother in a single instance, and Jesus does it for all of us for all time. So Jesus outdoes Judah in terms of graciousness, but it's still foreshadowed here.
Yes, definitely. That's quite powerful because we need to be looking at the immediate, but also the down the road as well, where this is really showing us some of the emotional side of it. We hear about Jesus crying at, weeping in the garden and praying to the Father, but this reveals the almost the human side of it for us.
Yeah, it does. And how this all starts in the past, but finds its fulfillment in the future, because Joseph, of course, we already know is the father of Ephraim and Manasseh. Mm-hmm. And Ephraim and Manasseh become two of the most powerful tribes in northern Israel after the split. For a little while, King Saul rules over united Israel. David rules over united Israel, all the tribes. Solomon rules over all of Israel. But under the reign of Solomon's son Rehoboam, the nation splits in two. And from that point on, it's really the tribe of Ephraim, one of Joseph's sons, that rules the north. Manasseh is a powerful tribe as well, and there's a little bit of overlap, but it's mostly Ephraim. And Judah rules the south. So these two characters of Joseph and Judah, they play out through the rest of the history of Israel as the prominent voices among the Israelites. And Ephraim is destroyed when the northern tribes are destroyed after just decades and centuries of sinfulness and rebellion against the law. They become the lost tribes of Israel. And Judah's all that remains by the time of Jesus, with a few stragglers from the tribe of Benjamin, like the Apostle Paul, who didn't get taken away, and certainly some from the tribe of Simeon, because their allotment was in the tribe of Judah, and some Levites, the ones who lived in the south, and Judah obviously survived. But the rest of them become the lost tribes of Israel. And when Jesus comes, he comes to seek those lost tribes, right? He comes to seek those lost sheep who have been scattered among the nations and all of that. And he represents the tribe of Judah, seeking, again, the lost tribe of Joseph. So I know we're going to hear in just a little bit from Joseph that he was sent ahead to save them. But the irony here is that the willingness of Judah to sacrifice himself to save Benjamin is actually the foreshadowing of the saving of Joseph. When Jesus comes to recollect what has been scattered. So it's just interesting how these stories in Genesis don't just play out in the life of Israel, but they even anticipate the New Testament. It's still Judah and Joseph. You know, sadly, Joseph's a very admirable character at this point. His children become quite rebellious. And Judah does too, but Judah lasts longer.
Yeah. Every generation has choices to make, right?
Right. But it's just so interesting how this very personal interaction ends up being replayed geopolitically in the history of Israel and then is consummated in the life of Jesus.
Right.
Even if you're super liberal on the dating and you think that Genesis reached its final form or maybe even was composed while the Israelites were in exile, that's probably the most liberal position that you could take. Even if you think that, they were in exile in the 500s. That's still 500 years before Jesus is born.
Right.
And this is played out in the life of Jesus. Now, of course, I'm much more inclined to believe that the first draft of Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy are penned by Moses, though I have no problem with the prophetic tradition of Israel doing some editing over time, updating place names and other things that they do, and adding in a few things like the death of Moses. There's some events after his death that clearly are added by the later prophetic tradition. I have no problem with it being worked on, but I tend to think that this is originally penned by Moses. And if that's the case, then we're talking about the foreshadowing of the entire history of Israel, along with the coming of Jesus, penned like centuries before the Israel's history unfolds and over a millennia before Jesus. It's just amazing.
Very much so. And then people who aren't in touch with it just read it as a text. Wouldn't necessarily buy that or understand that. I think it was recently, it might have been one of the podcasts I heard that you preached on, was that you can read the text, but without the Spirit of God revealing Himself to you, it just doesn't come alive. You don't have that interpretation or understanding.
And that's a long time teaching of the Christian Church,
yeah,
going back to the early fathers, that to read the text without the Spirit. You'll see different language in the earliest fathers. Like, they'll say that you have to read the text with the rule of faith is common language in the earliest writings. But if you don't read the scriptures with the Holy Spirit and the lens of the teachings of Jesus as preserved by the apostles, if you don't read with that personal guidance, you can interpret it any way you want. It ceases to be the word of God if it's not read with the Spirit.
Right.
And by someone in relationship with Jesus.
Right.
Quite honestly, most people who make their living talking about the Bible are not necessarily Christians.
Right.
But by their own testimony, that's not a value judgment. There are lots of people who profess as atheists who have PhDs in biblical studies of some sort. And I would say, I'm sure it's fun to read. They're not going to understand it.
Yeah, right. They don't have the keys.
Well, they're not reading with the God who authored it. So the intentions of the author are lost. All you can do is try to make the most you can out of the dry bones of the text.
Right.
Yeah.
Paleontologist, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's such an interesting story. I'm sorry I pushed us in a direction. I'll give you a chance to push us in another if you want to. But when you look at this interaction between Joseph and Judah, I don't want to force you to have to say what you think gets Joseph so worked up. But how do you respond to it?
Well, it certainly pulled, like I was saying before about the emotional pulling of the emotions. I feel like, you know, there's all this balled up emotion of all that's gone on in the past. I guess it brings up sympathy for Jacob and for Joseph in the situation, knowing that he is the one who has the higher hand right now, or the high ground and the ability to take advantage or eliminate his brothers if he wanted to. But you see a different type of interaction from Joseph here, where some people would be just like, yeah, I'm going to put it to these guys. I have the chance, and Dad sent them down here anyways, you know, probably thinking that none of them are going to return. But in the same token, I mean, the emotions, when you, I even think about, you know, we have family gatherings and such, that there's things to remember, and those memories, and, you know, I don't know about your family, what you do on holidays and stuff, but, you know, I remember days where we would sit around and play the game Pit, and that can get pretty aggressive. We would say, you know, everybody cut your fingernails now, and nobody's going to get hurt in this game. It's only a game, you know, but, remembering those times together are the things that help us through when things are a little bit more difficult. And I think that Joseph did a lot of that when he was in Egypt, or even on the way to Egypt, thinking about, you know, oh, I really would like to have those honey cakes that mom used to make. Or there's the remembering that I think the scriptures talk about too, is remembering that what God has done for us. And I think that the tenderness that he feels in desperate feeling from Judah, Joseph's heart he seems to be tender as well.
Yeah.
And that's important for this story and for this where we're at.
Yeah, we've known to this point in the Joseph story that he resisted Potiphar's wife's approaches to him, which was a powerful person in a position of authority pressuring him to do something for his own gain that he didn't feel was right to do. And he resisted that, which is, that's notable revelation of his character. And we know he's a hard worker. Like, we know that he worked hard for Potiphar. We know that he worked hard for the jailer, and that his work stood out. So we know that's another revelation of his character. But both those things could be true, and he could still want vengeance on his brother, on his brothers.
Right.
So this is also a crucible for Joseph,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, he's created a crucible for his brothers,
mm-hmm.
or a refiner's fire to see what they're made of. But it's also turned on him. It's revealing something about him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right to point out, because I think this is what I hear you saying, that Joseph's response in this situation tells us a great deal about the strength of his character as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So I've been saying Joseph is testing the spirits to a degree. He's testing to see if his brothers have changed, see what's happened to his father and his own full brother. He's trying to maybe see if they're trustworthy, because we're going to see soon that he's going to invite them to live in Egypt. So there's a lot he's doing here. He's testing the spirits. He's trying to see what these guys are made of. And maybe there's a little vengeance too, because I suspect he's also being a little hard on them, and he's playing some games with them. And I think when he was speaking roughly to them in the first scene, that was enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
I expect there was a little bit of sour grapes in that. So there's a lot going on here. And when we get caught in these situations, especially after we've been hurt, there's a lot of temptation to go too far,
mm-hmm.
to take pleasure where we shouldn't, to become like the victimizers when we confront them. And Joseph is navigating a lot of really choppy waters here.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with what you're saying, that he's coming out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Better than you would expect.
Right.
After all he's been through. Like, who could have blamed him from a human point of view for not just accusing all these guys of being spies, throwing them into prison, and throwing away the key and saying, why don't you sweat it out there? How many years was I in prison? 3, 4, 6, 7 years. Why don't you guys sweat it out for a while? We'll see how you are. Like, from a human perspective, who could blame him?
Yeah, right.
But he doesn't do that.
Yeah. He doesn't do it. I think you were on to something before. He doesn't do it because he realizes what it's doing to his dad.
Do you think he knew that before Judah just laid it all out on the table like that?
I think he might have had some inkling of it, but I think unless it's right in front of you, sometimes it doesn't become real for you.
And it's funny how this opportunity is given to Joseph to get rid of his brothers once he knows his dad's alive, go back home, and let God make a great nation out of him and Benjamin. Like, let's get rid of these guys that tried to get rid of me. That opportunity, this isn't the last time it will be offered. And it's been offered before. Like, this is what Jacob was afraid Esau would do to him. And later, I'm thinking of a scene in which Moses, after the Israelites, all of them, and they represent all 12 tribes. Moses is from the tribe of Levi. Levi doesn't come into this story very much at this point. He's been in it earlier. Mm-hmm. But Moses from the tribe of Levi. And the Lord says to him, the people have committed this great sin. I'm going to wipe them all out and I'll make a great nation from you. How's Moses going to respond to that? Joseph's in that situation. He has a way to get rid of all of his rivals if he wants to. He's in that situation. This will be repeated throughout Israel. In fact, it's similar to what Jesus is offered by Satan. Forget all those people. You just bow down to me and I'll give you the nations of the earth. Now, this opportunity to be the chosen one, to get rid of all the others, to be the favorite, you know, to be able, it's offered to them over and over again. But Joseph here doesn't do it. Moses refuses it as well and prays that God forgives the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the best characters do resist it. And Jesus, of course, refuses entirely. He intends to give his whole life to see everybody else redeemed. So it's just interesting that Joseph is resisting that temptation. It's got to be a powerful temptation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you just drew the line through history of showing that a person of character, a person who can see the bigger picture, a person who understands that God is working in a way through history in time to redeem his people, then they see the bigger picture. And you see that coming through, that often the eye seems to be the most important, but maybe that's the eye of the camel, or yeah, that the camel is supposed to go through.
And sometimes you find the same instinct that you see in Joseph, you see in Moses, you see in the best of characters in some pretty surprising places. I don't know how familiar you are with the work of now departed Christopher Hitchens, who died of cancer some years ago, but he was a very avowed atheist. And I say very avowed because he wasn't just an atheist, but he thought of it almost as a mission to make other people atheists. Like, he was did speeches and debates to try and persuade people that belief in God was a danger. And sometimes he went so far as to indicate in some of his speeches that he felt that without religion in the world would be a better place, that religion was the problem. But then there was this moment of a strange confession that I don't think the person interviewing him was even angling for. He almost just offered it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've sometimes been asked if I could get rid of every person of faith in the world, if I could banish religion from the landscape, if every person who avowed faith in Christianity or any other religion could be removed, would I do it? And the person interviewing him did not ask that question. He just volunteered it. And he said, I would not.
Mm-hmm.
And then he confessed he didn't know why. Mm-hmm. And there was another avowed atheist who I won't mention who was sitting with him in the car when he said that. And he looked at him like incredulously, like, you wouldn't? Why wouldn't you? You know, and at that moment, I saw in Christopher Hitchens a little glimmer of Moses, a little glimmer of Joseph. And I know he's an unbeliever, but still, you could see a little bit in him. He couldn't do it. He could not get rid of his enemies, who he thought of as enemy. He couldn't wipe them all out. Mm-hmm. And you can go all day long as to why, but I still... Sometimes there's a trace of God in all of us, and this is one of the places we find it when we're unwilling to banish our enemies to oblivion. It's a little bit of loving your enemies.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I mean, Jesus, you know, from the cross, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. And you look for it in the world, don't you?
Yeah.
Somebody like Joseph, because so many of us, we've been so hurt, so victimized, that we just can't even imagine showing mercy to those enemies.
Yeah.
But Joseph stands as one who has every reason to take all vengeance on these guys. Well, thank you, Minister Joe, and thanks everybody for joining us. I hope that this starts a conversation for you and doesn't end it. And obviously, we're giving our opinions as we read through this, wrestling to come to some godly conclusion.
Well, yeah. If you keep working it, the Lord will speak if you're seeking him.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk today. Appreciate it.
We'll see you next week.
Blessings on you.